The nylon rope was cutting into the flesh around his ankles. He was afraid to move because the rope seemed to give just a little. He was still 8 feet above the ground, and a fall would be disastrous. Inverted, Luther tried to breathe and collect his wits. He heard Frohmeyer's big mouth. "Would somebody please shoot me?" "Luther, you okay?" asked Frohmeyer. "Swell, Vic, thanks. And you?" Luther began, rotating again, slightly, turning very slowly in the wind. Soon he pivoted back toward the street and came face to face with his neighbors, the last people he wanted to see. "Get a ladder," someone said. "Is that an electrical cord around his feet?" asked someone else. "Where is the rope attached?" asked another. All the voices were familiar, but Luther couldn't distinguish them. "I called 911," he heard Walt Scheel say. "Thanks, Walt," Luther said loudly in the direction of the crowd, but he was revolving back toward the house. "I think Frosty's dead," one teenager mumbled to another. Hanging there, waiting for death, waiting for the rope to slip, then give completely and send him crashing down, Luther hated Christmas with a renewed passion. Look what Christmas was doing to him. All because of Christmas. And he hated his neighbors, too, all of them, young and old. They were gathering in his driveway by the dozens now. He could hear them coming, and as he rotated slowly, he could glimpse them running down the street to see this sight. The cord and the rope popped somewhere above him, then gave, and Luther fell another 6 inches before he was jerked to another stop. The crowd gasped. No doubt, some of them wanted to cheer. Frohmeyer was barking orders as if he handled these situations every day. Two ladders arrived, and one was placed on each side of Luther. Ned Becker yelled from the back patio that he'd found what was holding the electrical cord and the nylon rope, and, in his very experienced opinion, it wouldn't hold much longer. "Did you plug in the extension cord?" Frohmeyer asked. "No," answered Luther. "We're going to get you down, okay?" "Yes, please." Frohmeyer was climbing one ladder, Ned Becker the other. Luther was aware that Suede Kerr was down there, as was Ralph Brixley and John Galdi, and some of the older boys on the street. "My life is in their hands," Luther said to himself, and closed his eyes. He weighed 174, down 11 for the cruise, and he was quite concerned with how exactly they planned to untangle him, then lower him to the ground. His rescuers were middle-aged men who, if they broke a sweat, did so on the golf course. Certainly not powerlifting. Suede Kerr was a frail vegetarian who could barely pick up his newspaper, and right then he was under Luther hoping to help lower him to the ground. "What's the plan here, Vic?" Luther asked. It was difficult to talk with his feet straight above him. Gravity was pulling all the blood to his head, and it was pounding. Vic hesitated. They really didn't have a plan. What Luther couldn't see was that a group of men was standing directly under him to break any fall. What Luther could hear, though, were two things. First, someone said, "There's Nora!" Then he heard sirens. 18. The crowd parted to allow the ambulance through. It stopped 10 feet from the ladders, from the man hanging by his feet and his would-be rescuers. Two medics and a fireman jumped out, removed the ladders, shooed back Frohmeyer and his cohorts. Then one of them drove the ambulance carefully under Mr. Crank. "Luther, what are you doing up there?" Nora yelled as she rushed through the crowd. "What does it look like?" he yelled back, and his head pounded harder. "Are you okay?" "Wonderful." The medics and the firemen crawled up on the hood of the ambulance, quickly lifted Luther a few inches, unraveled the cord and the rope, then eased him down. A few folks applauded, but most seemed indifferent. The medics checked his vitals, then lowered him to the ground and carried him to the back of the ambulance where the doors were open. Luther's feet were numb, and he couldn't stand. He was shivering, so a medic draped two orange blankets over him. As he sat there in the back of the ambulance, looking toward the street, trying to ignore the gawking mob that was no doubt reveling in his humiliation, Luther could only feel relief. His headfirst slide down the roof had been brief, but horrifying. He was lucky to be conscious right now. Let them stare. Let them gawk. He ached too much to care. Nora was there to inspect him. She recognized the fireman Kistler and the medic Kendall as the two fine young men who'd stopped by a couple of weeks ago selling fruitcakes for their holiday fundraiser. She thanked them for rescuing her husband. "You want to go to the hospital?" asked Kendall. "Just a precaution," said Kistler. No thanks, Luther said, his teeth chattering. Nothing's broken. At that moment, though, everything felt broken. A police car arrived in a rush and parked in the street, of course with its lights still flashing. Trine and Celino jumped out and strutted through the crowd to observe things. Frohmeyer, Becker, Kerr, Scheel, Brixley, Kropp, Goldie, Bellington, they all eased in around Luther and Nora. Spike was in the middle of them, too. As Luther sat there, nursing his wounds, answering banal questions from the boys in uniform, practically all of Hemlock squeezed in for a better view. When Celino got the gist of the story, he said rather loudly, "Frosty, I thought you guys weren't doing Christmas this year, Mr. Crank. First you borrow a tree, now this." "What's going on, Luther?" Frohmeyer called out. It was a public question. Its answer was for everyone. Luther looked at Nora and realized she wasn't about to say a word. The explanations belonged to him. "Blair's coming home for Christmas," he blurted, rubbing his left ankle. "Blair's coming home," Frohmeyer repeated loudly, and the news rippled through the crowd. Regardless of how they felt about Luther at the moment, the neighbors adored Blair. They'd watched her grow up, sent her off to college, and waited for her to come back each summer. She'd babysat for most of the younger kids on Hemlock. As an only child, Blair had treated the other children like family. She was everyone's big sister. "And she's bringing her fiancé," Luther added, and this too swept through the onlookers. "Who's Blair?" asked Celino, as if he were a homicide detective digging for clues. "She's my daughter," Luther explained to the uninformed. "She left about a month ago for Peru with the Peace Corps. Not going to be back for a year, so we thought. She called around 11 today. She was in Miami coming home to surprise us for Christmas, and she's bringing a fiancé, some doctor she just met down there." Nora moved closer and was now holding his elbow. "And she expects to see a Christmas tree?" Frohmeyer said. "Yes." "And a Frosty?" "Of course." "And what about the annual Crank Christmas Eve party?" "That too." The crowd inched closer as Frohmeyer analyzed things. "What time does she get here?" he asked. "Plane lands at 6. "6?" People looked at their watches. Luther rubbed the other ankle. His feet were tingling now, a good sign. Blood was flowing down there again. Vic Frohmeyer took a step back and looked into the faces of his neighbors. He cleared his throat, raised his chin, and began. "Okay, folks, here's the game plan. We're about to have a party here at the Cranks, a Christmas homecoming for Blair. Those of you who can, drop what you're doing and pitch in. Nora, do you have a turkey?"
"No," she said sheepishly. "Smoked trout."
"Smoked trout? That's all I could find." Several of the women whispered, "Smoked trout?" "Who has a turkey?" Frohmeyer asked.
"We have two," said Jude Becker, "both in the oven."
"Great," said Frohmeyer. "Cliff, you take a team down to Brixley's and get his Frosty. Get some lights, too. We'll string them along Luther's boxwoods here. Everybody go home, change clothes, grab whatever extra food you can find, and meet back here in a half hour." He looked at Celino and Trine and said, "You guys head to the airport."
"For what?" asked Celino.
"Blair needs a ride home."
"I'm not sure if we can.
Shall I call the chief?" Trine and Celino headed for their car. The neighbors began to scatter, now that they had their instructions from Frohmeyer. Luther and Nora watched them disperse up and down Hemlock, all moving quickly, all with a purpose. Nora looked at Luther with tears in her eyes, and Luther felt like crying, too. His ankles were raw. Frohmeyer said, "How many guests are coming to the party?"
"Oh, I don't know," Nora said, staring at the empty street.
"Not as many as you think," Luther said to her. "The Underwoods called and canceled, as did Doc's."
"So did Father Zabriskie," said Nora.
"Not Mitch Underwood," queried Frohmeyer.
"Yes, but he's not coming."
What a sad little party, thought Frohmeyer.
"So how many guests do you need?"
"Everybody's invited," Luther said. "The whole street."
"Yes, the entire street," Nora added.
Frohmeyer looked at Kistler and asked, "How many guys in the station tonight?"
8.
"Can the firemen and medics come too?" Vic asked Nora.
"Yes, they're all invited," she said.
"And the police as well," added Luther.
"It'll be a crowd."
"A crowd would be nice, wouldn't it, Luther?" Nora said. He pulled the blankets tighter and said, "Yes, Blair would love a crowd."
"How about some carolers?" Frohmeyer asked.
"That would be nice," Nora said.
They helped Luther into the house, and by the time he made it to the kitchen, he was walking unassisted, but with a severe limp. Kendall left him a plastic cane, one he vowed he wouldn't use. When they were alone in the living room with Trogdon's tree, Luther and Nora shared a few quiet moments by the fire. They talked about Blair. They tried in vain to analyze the prospect of a fiancé, then a groom, then a new son-in-law. They were touched beyond words by the unity of their neighbors. The cruise was never mentioned. Nora looked at her watch and said she had to get ready. "I wish I'd had a camera," she said, walking away. "You up there hanging by your feet with half the city watching?" And she laughed all the way to the bedroom. 19. Blair was just a little miffed that her parents were not waiting at the arrival gate. Sure, it was short notice, and the airport was crowded, and they were undoubtedly busy with the party. But she was, after all, bringing home her one and only. She said nothing, though, as she and Enrique walked quickly down the concourse arm in arm, stride for stride, somehow weaving gracefully through the mob while remaining attached at the hip and staring only at each other. There was no one to greet them at the baggage claim, either. But as they were hauling their luggage toward the exit, Blair saw two policemen holding a hand-scrawled sign that read, "Blair and Enrique." They had misspelled Enrique, but at the moment, who cared? She called to them, and they snapped into action, scooping up the luggage and leading them through the mass of people. Officer Cellino explained as they walked outside that the chief had dispatched a police escort for Blair and Enrique. "Welcome home." "The party is waiting," he said as they stuffed their things into the trunk of a police car, which was parked illegally at the curb in front of the taxis. A second police car was parked in front of the first. As a South American, Enrique was more than a little hesitant to voluntarily get into the back of a police car. He looked around nervously at the crush of foot traffic, taxis and buses, bumper to bumper, people yelling, guards whistling. The idea of bolting crossed his mind, and then his eyes returned to the beautiful face of the girl he loved. "Let's go," she said, and they jumped in. He would have followed her anywhere. With lights flashing, the two cars flew away, darting through traffic, forcing others onto the edges of the streets. "This happens all the time?" Enrique whispered. "Never," Blair answered. What a nice touch, she thought. Officer Treen was driving furiously. Officer Cellino was smiling at the thought of Luther Crank hanging by his feet while the entire neighborhood looked on. But he wouldn't say a word. Blair would never know the truth, according to orders from Vic Frohmeyer, who'd finally gotten through to the mayor and also had the chief's ear. As they worked their way into the suburbs, the traffic thinned, and a light snow began. "Calling for 4 inches," Cellino said over his shoulder. "Does it snow down in Peru?" "In the mountains," Enrique said. "But I live in Lima, the capital." "Had a cousin went to Mexico one time," Cellino said, but let it go because there was nothing else to add. The cousin had almost died, etc., but Cellino wisely decided not to venture into third-world horror stories. Blair was determined to be hyper-protective of her fiancé and his homeland, so she quickly rushed in with, "Has it snowed since Thanksgiving?" The subject of weather was the most common ground of all. "Had 2 inches a week ago, wasn't it?" Cellino said, glancing at Treen, who was driving with white knuckles in a successful attempt to keep his car no more than 5 feet behind the police car in front of them. 4 inches, Treen said with authority. "No, it was 2, wasn't it?" Cellino argued. 4, Treen said, shaking his head, and this irritated Cellino. They finally settled on 3 inches of snow as Blair and Enrique huddled in the back and looked at the rows of neatly decorated houses. "Almost there," she said softly. "That's Stanton. Hemlock is next." Spike was the lookout. He flashed green twice on his Boy Scout signal lantern, and the stage was set. Luther limped pitifully into their bathroom, where Nora was putting the finishing touches on her face. For 20 minutes, she'd been desperately experimenting with everything she could find. Foundations, powders, highlights. Her wonderfully tanned skin was hidden from the neck down, and she was determined to lighten her face. It wasn't working, though. "You look emaciated," Luther said, truthfully. Powder was flying around her head. Luther was in too much pain to worry about his tan. At Nora's suggestion, he was wearing black, black cardigan over a black turtleneck with dark gray slacks. The darker his attire, the paler his skin, in her opinion. The cardigan he'd worn only once, and luckily it was one Blair had given him for a birthday. The turtleneck had never been worn, and neither he nor Nora could remember where it came from. He felt like a mafia lieutenant.
"Just give it up," he said as she flung bottles and seemed ready to throw one at him.
"I will not," she snapped.
"Blair will not know about the cruise. Do you understand, Luther?"
"Then don't tell her about the cruise. Tell her your doctor recommended tanning for, which vitamin is it?"
"C, from the sunshine, not a tanning bed. Another stupid idea, Luther."
"Tell her we've had some unseasonably warm weather, been outside a lot, working in the flower beds."
"That's your lie, and it's not going to work. She's not blind. She'll look at your flower beds and see they haven't been touched in months."
"Ouch. Any more bright ideas?"
"We're getting a head start on spring break. Bought a tanning package."
"Very funny."
She brushed by him in a huff, powder trailing behind her. Luther was limping down the hall with his new plastic cane toward the crowd in his living room when he heard someone yell, "Here they come!" Due to a malfunctioning canvas strap, Ralph Brixley was actually holding his